Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Hello and a warm welcome to DW's Africa Link program, coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
With me, Jen Ayeko Kumet. Remember, we are live on Facebook at DW Africa. And in today's program, embattled South African President Jacob Zuma now faces a vote of no confidence by his own ruling ANC party.
I came through Parliament. If Parliament says we don't want to, those are the people who elected me. Why should there be a problem? I would be out.
And it's been 1 year since German journalist Deniz Yücel was arrested and detained in Turkey. Are there any hopes of him being released soon?
There are reports about certain deals between the German and Turkish government, and it's very likely Ankara doesn't let Yücel go without getting anything in return. So I really don't expect Mr. Yücel to walk out of Silivri prison here at the outskirts of Istanbul within the next days.
Stay tuned for these stories, plus, of course, your comments and thoughts on them live on air. But as always, all this after we get a briefing of other stories that have been making rounds in the world.
My name is Jen Nyinge with DW News. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has refused to step down despite an ultimatum from his party that he leaves today or face a vote of no confidence. Speaking on state television, the embattled leader called the move against him by the ruling ANC party as very unfair. Paul Mashatile, who is the party's treasurer general, explains their next course of action.
By tomorrow, a motion of no confidence will be tabled, debated, to remove the President of the Republic. Then all other processes kick in. If it goes through that process, it means the government will dissolve. Speaker will be acting president. The Constitution allow up until perhaps, I think, maximum of 30 days. But we want to do things quicker.
Now to Libya, where it's been reported a truck packed with African migrants crashed in the town of Bani Walid, leaving at least 19 people dead and more than 100 injured. More than 300 migrants, mostly Eritrean and Somali nationals, were on board. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he will continue to serve his position despite calls by the opposition to resign. This comes a day after the police said there was sufficient evidence to indict him on charges of corruption. Netanyahu has also dismissed any cracks in his party.
First of all, I want to reassure you that the coalition is stable. No one, not myself, not anyone else, plans to hold elections. We will continue to work together for the people of Israel until the end of the term. I'm confident, as I've always been, that the truth will come to light and nothing will come out of this.
This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. The Ethiopian government has today set free an opposition leader, a journalist, and also dropped charges against a group of bloggers in a wave of prisoner releases and pardons. Politician Adulem Arage was serving a life sentence on accusation of links to the outlawed opposition group Gimbot 7. International donors have pledged billions of dollars for Iraq's reconstruction after the country's war with the so-called IS. Iraq had told an international donor conference that rebuilding the country will cost more than $88 billion. And now to the ongoing Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, and Germany has added two more golds from the men's double luge. This brings to 7 the total number of golds won by Germany on the 5th day of the event. For more news and information, please visit our website dw.com or our Facebook page DW Africa. My name is Jen Nyinge.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link, coming to you from our studios here in Bonn. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And I'm Jen Ayeko Kumet. And we go right away to South Africa, where the ruling ANC party is still struggling to get the scandal-ridden President Jacob Zuma out of office. The party has now unveiled its latest plan, being a parliamentary vote of no confidence. In his first public speech since the party started holding meetings to remove him from office, Zuma was defiant, saying that that the ANC had not given him any reason to resign and that he was ready to face the very parliament that voted him in. But as pressure mounts on him to leave office, the country's elite police, also the Hawks, raided the home of his business friends, the Guptas, arresting three persons, including one of the Gupta brothers. Subri Govinda brings us that story.
President Jacob Zuma said he had reached an agreement with the leader of the ANC, Cyril Ramaphosa, to step down from office within 3 to 6 months. He had pointed out that he only wanted to step down after he had introduced the new leader to the AU and the BRICS group of countries. But that is not all. Zuma maintained that he had not been given any reason why he should step down immediately.
It's the first time I feel a decision is not right, and I disagree with it. I think it is important for me to say this because out there in the narrative, it looks like, as people are saying, Zuma is defying. I've not defied. I've disagreed with a decision taken.
If Zuma does not resign, the ANC will be forced to go for a vote of no confidence against him. This is likely to be introduced on Thursday. This too does not seem to bother Zuma, who said he was elected by Parliament as president and therefore he was prepared to face the vote of no confidence.
They're taking me to Parliament, and of course that's how I came in. I came through Parliament. If Parliament says we don't want to, those are the people who elected me, why should there be a problem? I would be out.
The Speaker of Parliament, Baleke Mbete, confirmed the vote of no confidence option and stated that Parliament would vote for a new president tomorrow, Thursday, if Zuma would have stepped down by then.
And then we can proceed to a joint sitting, which we will agree on tomorrow morning in a joint program committee. The joint sitting sits late on Friday if all things go according to our plan, for the new president to deliver a State of the Nation address.
Opposition parties in Parliament have welcomed the vote of no confidence motion against Zuma and said that Zuma should no longer be the president. John Steenhuisen of the DA, Democratic Alliance, said Zuma must not only be voted out, but must also face corruption charges.
I think he does deserve to be impeached. But even if he walks away for his benefits, they're not going to help him out in jail. President Zuma is going to end up in jail.
A political analyst, Karima Brown, said Zuma would be going out of office in the same way as he had come into power some 10 years ago.
What we've seen, it is going to be a terrible end. Many people arguing he's going out of power in the same manner he came into power, inauspicious.
Meanwhile, the Hawks Prosecution Unit of the National Prosecution Authority early on Wednesday raided the homestead of Zuma's business friends, the Guptas, in Johannesburg. They confiscated a large quantity of files and arrested three people, including one of the Gupta brothers. They will appear in court on Thursday on charges that they had unlawfully benefited from a dairy farm project to the tune of 28 million rand. Zuma has been accused of being captured by the Gupta business family.
Zubri Govinda winding up that story with that latest on the Gupta family. Now, that is something that has sent our listeners and our followers on Facebook talking. For instance, Percy Cameron here says, Gupta men and families, these people exist everywhere. But the problem is that they worsen the situation in Africa for their own benefits and the peril of millions of needy people. Cameroon has not only Gupta men, but also a Gupta government. That's
Gupta
what
government. An interesting one over there.
Yes.
All right. And on Zuma's refusal to step down, there's one comment coming from Adam Meftikal. He says, it's indeed absurd to see old, bald-headed, corrupt African leaders trying hard not to step down after duping and embezzling state coffers to their own selfish gains.
Interesting. Let's come back to Europe.
Right. Let's return to Germany. And one of the big stories here today is that February 14th marks exactly 1 year since German journalist Deniz Yücel was taken into custody by Turkish police in Istanbul. His ongoing detention without trial has become a contentious issue and an obstacle in relations between Germany and Turkey. Berlin has vowed to use all within its power to seek Yücel's freedom. But Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who accuses the 43-year-old journalist who has both Turkish and German citizenships of being a spy and a terrorist, says he will never permit UGL to leave for Germany. I've been speaking to Yulia Han, DW correspondent in Istanbul, to find out if there are any signs of UGL being released anytime soon.
Well, the Turkish Prime Minister Yildirim, who is visiting Germany right now for political talks, gave an interview saying he is expecting developments in Mr. Yücel's case, and I quote him, anytime soon. But of course, it remains to be seen what that means exactly, because at the same time, he says it's up to the Turkish judiciary to decide. So the same judiciary who couldn't come up with an indictment so far. It's been 1 year. Deniz Yücel is in jail. You mentioned that. So at least an indictment needs to be presented soon by state prosecutors here in Turkey so things can move ahead. So I really don't expect Mr. Yücel to walk out of Silivri prison here at the outskirts of Istanbul within the next days.
But again, also, it's a bit ironic that he says that it's up to the judiciary when the president, Recep Erdogan, already has involved himself by saying that he will never allow Yücel to leave for Germany.
Well, that's correct. Many people here, including lawyers, human rights activists, have huge doubts whether the Turkish judiciary, in fact, is still acting independent or whether it is actually following a political agenda dictated by the president himself.
And there are also reports that his freedom could come in the form of a swap between pro-coup supporters who fled to Germany and himself being released. How true are these reports, and how much support does such a plan have in Ankara?
Well, no matter what the Turkish side thinks and wants, the German government can't extradite these people without breaching international human rights obligations. After all, the Turkish government has threatened to reintroduce capital punishment for suspected members of the Gulen movement. These are the people Ankara blames for the attempted coup in summer 2016. So this is not really an option for Germany. But yes, there are reports about certain deals between the German and Turkish government, and it's very likely Ankara doesn't let Yücel go without getting anything in return, political or economic concessions. Even a deal about Germany modernizing Turkish tanks was reportedly on the table, but Yücel himself is saying he doesn't want to be part of any dirty deal. He doesn't want his freedom to be tainted.
And how much of an obstacle is Yücel's detention to Turkey and Germany relations, and eventually to Turkey's ambition of joining the European Union?
Well, I think his case is a very good example of how the plight of an individual journalist can turn into a very serious foreign policy matter and a bilateral crisis. It's really one of the core obstacles here. The German government has a very clear position. They say there cannot be any normalization in bilateral relations as long as there are German citizens behind bars in Turkey for political reasons. At the same time, the Turkish president Erdogan clearly said Yücel will not be released as long as he is in office. So there needs to be a solution somehow to this crisis. Germany is right now struggling to form a government. That doesn't make it easier. And when it comes to EU membership talks, they are on hold right now. Nothing is really happening there. The EU Parliament last week again heavily criticized the human rights situation here in Turkey, with dozens of journalists like Deniz Yücel being behind bars, and tens of thousands of people who got sacked or suspended, many even arrested in Turkey's post-coup crackdown. So for Germany, Deniz Yücel is a very important issue, but overall his fate is not the only obstacle.
DW correspondent in Istanbul, Yulia Han. Now, Eugene, let's go back to our
the Guptas.
The Gupta and Zuma. Exactly. That's our main story today. And there's one coming in from YB Saleh, and he says it is undemocratic to ask a duly elected president to step down. Western press like DW should be in the forefront to condemn this move by the ANC rather than lamenting Zuma's refusal to step down. And he got a very good response from our social media editor, who responded by saying, well, it is actually his party that put him there, and it's the same party that has asked him to step down. Our job as the media is to report, not to condemn or to support.
Interesting how our followers have actually come up with this as a concept. It's no longer just the Guptas in South Africa, but now they are calling it a concept. And another person says that in Nigeria, these people are there and they are called the cabals. They hide behind politics to influence every administration. And from Congo, Patrick says, praise God, Africa is beginning to wake up.
Well, thanks for all those comments. Keep it here at Africa Link and visit our Facebook page, DW Africa.
case you've just joined in, this is DW Africa Link with me, Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And I'm Crispin Mwakide. We welcome your comments on the stories that we are covering. Just go to our Facebook page, DW Africa, and leave your comments. So we'll read them, some of them, right here on air. And coming up in the next 15 minutes, the conflict between Fulani herdsmen and farmers forces hundreds to flee their homes in central Nigeria.
And they are always coming, killing, destroying our properties. You can see small children are not here now. We were able to push them down to Makurdi for security purpose.
Plus, another conflict could be unfolding in Kenya, but this one has nothing to do with the Fulanis, but rather flowers. Don't miss out on that report, which coincides with Valentine's Day. But first, let's head to Nigeria, where a police officer has been killed and his body mutilated. His death is the latest blow to the violence between Fulani herdsmen and farmers in the central part of Nigeria.
More than 100 people have been killed since January, and the government has deployed security forces in a bid to quell the insecurity. DW's Adrian Krish toured a camp for the internally displaced in Benue State, and his report is now read by Isaac Mugabe.
Inside an unfinished primary school, which has been turned into a shelter for internally displaced persons, lies an exhausted woman on the dusty floor. She is the mother of Christopher Bakio. Almost 2 weeks ago, her village was attacked by herdsmen, so they all fled to Makurdi, the provincial capital. Although the refugees have running water, they are still waiting for food and medical supplies, as well as mattresses to sleep on. Nevertheless, Bakio says they are happy to be alive.
So it's good as we are here, we are suffering, but we are living, we are alive. We thank God for this.
Two people were killed in the attack on Bakio's village. All the others have now fled. Seven camps for refugees have already opened. But more and more people are fleeing their villages. The security situation in Benue State is becoming increasingly troubling. Many residents blame Fulani herdsmen for mounting raids on the farming community. Isaac Uzio is a villager and shares his concerns.
And they are always coming, killing, destroying our properties. You can see small children are not here now. We were able to push them down to Makurdi for security purpose. And they are coming. And they used to come in the night. So that is the fear.
But that fear is on both sides. Fulani herdsmen are now considered trespassers by most farmers and thus risk being attacked. Garba Hussaini, a Fulani herdsman, says he's no longer allowed to graze his cows and has to buy fodder for his livestock. What's even more, he too fears for his own life.
I'm here, but I'm feeling afraid because I can't walk inside town, go find food to shop. I'm fearing. Anywhere they see me, they'll go kill me. I call a Fulani. The two parts, they kill one another. Anybody then kill, go say, go revenge. That revenge ain't the prime problem. Farmers, they kill, rearers, they kill. Now that revenge destroyed the country.
The government of President Muhammadu Buhari has been criticized for not doing enough to stop the killings. Samuel Oltom, the governor of Benue State, told DW he blames Abuja, even though he himself is a member of the ruling party.
I don't have state police. I don't have state army. I don't have Navy, Air Force, and all that. I have done the needful by reporting to the presidency. As far as I'm concerned, this is a complete failure.
Last year, Autumn passed a law that no longer allows pastoralists to move freely with their livestock. This measure has not reduced the number of attacks, but instead aggravated the tensions. And as the conflict threatens to assume ethnic dimensions, Christopher Bakio and other displaced people have to stay in camps for the foreseeable future.
And that report was written by Adrian Krish.
Now, Crispin, just to pick up on that story, we learned that the government of Plateau State in Nigeria has provided money to build livestock stations. Now, this is intended to diffuse the conflicts between the Fulani herdsmen and farmers. We asked on our Facebook, can the nomadic Fulani be persuaded to change their way of life? And Ako Amadi says, it's not a question of persuasion to change a way of life, but more of a good governance to instill a sense of belonging to a nation state in all Nigerians. That is the problem. He goes on to say most Nigerians are still are fast, citizens of their tribe, and then part-time citizens of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. That's quite a strong one, but also very insightful.
Very, very interesting there. And Frankie Okonkwo says, where in the world will a group of people kill 73 people, and after weeks, the government doesn't even send security officials there? No government officials visited the area even during the burial.
On the spot.
Now, today, Wednesday, I guess many of you out there do know that it's Valentine's Day, a day that many across the globe will be celebrating and exchanging love tokens like flowers, chocolates, or getting cards. In fact, there is a good chance that if you are buying flowers today, they may have started their life way in Kenya.
That's right, because the flower industry has been touted as providing a big boost to East African economies. But there is a cost behind all that beauty, as Andrew Wasikia reports. He went to Lake Naivasha in Kenya to find out the other cost behind those Valentine's Day flowers.
The biggest part of Kenya's flower industry is here, along the shores of the fresh Lake Naivasha. Kenya is among the world's top cut flower exporters, and most of the flowers I can see growing here will be shipped to Europe and the Americas. According to the CEO of Kenya Flower Council, Clement Tulezi, flower sales provide about 75% of the country's turnover. And Valentine's Day means big business for this region, with huge amounts of pre-orders for export flowers. But as consumers are spreading love across the world, they might not be aware of how this business is having a negative impact on the lives of thousands of Kenyans, mainly because of allegations of environmental damage. Recently, water levels have been diminishing and dead fish float in the water that is left or lie rotting on the newly exposed mudbanks. Local people are now starting to point their fingers at the thousands of flower farms located on the shores of Lake Naivasha. Desmond Ogutu is just one among hundreds who make a living from Lake Naivasha.
At the moment, we have no means of earning a living. We cannot feed our children.
Ben Musundi is a local resident who was at the lake with his family. He goes even further.
We are poisoning the people in Naivasha, and we are killing the lives in the water.
Representatives from the flower farms, though, deny these allegations. John Oss is the general manager for Osirian Flower Farms.
The problem is not on the flower farms per se. The problem is coming in from a failed sewage system.
Ornithologist Don Turner disagrees with Oss and has been watching the lake for many years.
I think I first came here in 61 or 62, and it was the most remarkable sight. Lake Naivasha was the greatest waterbird spectacle in East Africa. But sadly, as I say, a series of human errors, the lake has declined. I've seen it happen in my lifetime. I never thought I would. I don't think the government should have allowed the horticulture industry to site itself along the shore of this lake. It's very badly polluted. In fact, it's toxic.
Tekla Mutia is an environmental scientist and has been studying the lake and found dead fish with high quantities of lead, copper, and cadmium present.
The most striking result was that in fish mussels, lead was 100 times higher than what is recommended for consumption. Lead is an active ingredient of agrochemicals, which are quite dominant in use as pesticides around the flower farms.
Musia Mwinzi from the National Environment Management Authority described the condition that the dead fish were found in.
They were actually having their mouths open, their gills, all their gills and their fins open, indicating they were struggling to breathe. They died mostly from suffocation.
For now, there are no direct measures in place, but scientists have warned that frying and eating fish from the lake could lead to a myriad of diseases associated with chemical poisoning.
Andrew Wasike reporting there in Kenya.
Now, are you one of those ones who celebrates Valentine's Day, Crispin? I have to ask you this
one. I'm definitely not in red, so you get the answer there.
That's a good one. And we actually did pose this question on our social media platform, and we got some responses. For instance, one from Charles Ongole John from Uganda here, who says, I'm not exactly eager to celebrate Valentine's Day because it's absurdly misunderstood and and bastardized in Uganda, largely by ignorant use as a day for immoral sex.
Right. And there's another comment from Gideon, who says, I have no reason to celebrate it because we all have different perceptions concerning what it means. Although I know they celebrate it, but to me, it does not mark immorality that people used to attach to it.
And Wisdom Noa Biafra, that's what he calls his name, says, for me, today is just a normal day.
Joseph agrees and says, I don't celebrate the day because love is an everyday issue.
I think
not just on February 14th.
I think I tend to agree with Joseph. That's a good one. And we'll leave it at that for now. We shall come back to those comments a little later.
Living Planet Africa.
Now, climate change is real. That is the message we often hear during climate change meetings. In the bigger part of Africa, environmental degradation and deforestation are very evident, mostly resulting from people cutting trees for use as a source of energy.
And in Rwanda, the government is fighting this, and it has introduced heavy tax incentives on liquefied petroleum gas to make cooking gas affordable to the majority of ordinary Rwandese. From Kigali, Nasra Bishumba filed this report.
In 2010, Rwanda set out to reduce the number of people using charcoal and firewood as a source of energy from 90 to 50% by 2020. To achieve this, it reduced taxes on liquid gas so as to make it affordable. But 7 years down the road, it has only achieved a decline of 4% increase of those using gas. Claudine Wanyirigira is an office messenger and a single mother of one. She tells me why she continues to use charcoal.
I prefer to use charcoal instead of gas because charcoal is cheaper. Depending on my salary, the amount I get can't allow me to buy this big bottle of gas at once. 80,000 is a lot of money. With my income, I can easily afford to buy charcoal because even if I have 300 or 500, I can go in store and buy my charcoal and make the food for my kid. As a single mom, this is better.
Francine Rujesa, who runs Shalom Shalom gas vending store, tells me that the government needs to change strategy about how they sell the idea of switching to clean energy.
I think it's the mindset, because when you compare the price of a sack of charcoal at 10,000 francs, which is about 9 euros, and gas at 12,000 francs, and the number of days that they can each be used, it's really the same. Then there is the issue of poverty. Not everyone can afford buying the gas cylinder, the gas and the stove. It's not easy. Perhaps it's time to provide different gas sales packages so that way you have a choice of charcoal which costs 1,000 francs and you also have an option of gas that costs the same. Truthfully, if they were to get all that, gas would be their better choice.
While the government claims it has scrapped taxes on liquefied gas in 2012, the incentive does not favor low-income households since it only covers the gas and cylinder, not the fittings including the pipe, regulator and the cooking stoves, which carry the bulkier part of the cost. Rwandan Minister of Environment, Dr. Vincent Biruta, says the government is working on a more affordable way to help low-income earners to afford the new technology.
Let's remember that gas is a petroleum product and the prices of this oil fluctuate all the time, and there is nothing that we can do about that. What the government is doing, though, is to find ways how its people can use gas without being weighed down by the cost. It can be expensive to buy the gas cylinder, plus the gas and the cooking stove, but there are ways like paying in installments that can make this possible.
That report was compiled by Nasra Bishumba in Kigali.
And that's all we had time for. Thank you for listening to Africa Link. That's from me, Jane Ayeko Kumet.
And Crispin Mwakideo. Thanks.
Have a nice day.
Goodbye.